from the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. And ladies and gentlemen, I think this is going to be one of the most important radio shows that I have ever done throughout my career. Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative, the research. We have at our microphone today Dr. Pam Lattimore. She is the principal scientist, Research Triangle Institute. She's from the Crime and Violence and Justice Research Program, www.rti.org. www.rti.org. There was a piece of research, a very, very, very significant piece of research, again, called the Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative. 12 states did adult programs, 4 states did juvenile programs. It was evaluated twice, once at the 3-year level and once at the 5-year level. And I think you're going to be surprised at the findings between the 3- and the 5-year level. To Pam Lattimore, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you, Lynn. Glad to be here.
I find this piece of research fascinating. I think that this may be the most important piece of research on offender reentry in this country's history. There's been lots of wonderful stuff out there in terms of substance abuse, in terms of GPS, in terms of Project Hope and specialized courts, and their findings are encouraging. But this is mainstream reentry, as we call it today, in terms of providing programs to people coming out of the prison system, services coming out of the prison system. So give me your quick summation as to the Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative.
Okay, the initiative was actually funded by Congress in about 2000, and $100 million roughly was given to 69 state agencies to do programs, reentry programs for adults and juveniles. Mm-hmm. And as an evaluation was commissioned to study those programs.
Right.
We looked at all 69 grantees, identified what they were doing, and from those grantees selected 16 programs, 12 adult, 4 juvenile, to evaluate.
But there were many more beyond this. So these 16 programs are sort of illustrative, indicative of the experience that happened throughout the country.
That's right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it was funded by the Office of Justice Programs.
That's correct.
The U.S. Department of Justice. And so this is significant because it involves you evaluated, and there are far more programs than this, 12 states with adult programs, 4 states with juvenile programs. They provided services, an array of services as they came out. They were guidelines, general guidelines, in terms of what it was that these jurisdictions were supposed to provide. Give me a sense at the 3-year level what the findings were in terms of the research.
The findings, and they were supposed to provide an array of services, but there were core services, and it's the core that I think has sort of been the landmark, hallmark of reentry programming.
Mm-hmm.
It's needs assessment, reentry planning, mm-hmm. Reentry plan, case management to get people into services.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that with any reentry program, the programming begins in prison and then transitions out into the community.
Mm-hmm.
The findings were that individuals that were in the programs received more services than those who were not. So that's
right.
Always a positive thing.
Yes.
You don't want to be studying people who got the same thing and then
right.
See if there's any differences in outcomes.
Right.
And that we saw modest improvements across a variety of domain areas.
Okay.
The initial results at three years, basically a 2-year follow-up post prison release,
mm-hmm.
was that although the numbers were in the right directions. There were slightly fewer arrests for the people that were in program. The differences weren't large enough for them to qualify as, you know, what researchers call statistically significant.
Right, and which means that it's not due to chance.
Right.
It's due to program initiative.
That's right.
You
that's
had a
right.
control group, correct?
That's right. We had a comparison group that was carefully matched
okay.
with the treatment groups.
Okay. And so there's a certain point within the 3-year program where people sat back and said, you know, where there were reductions and we were moving in the right direction, we're not overly enthused about the results at the 3-year level. Am I in the ballpark?
You are in the ballpark. I mean, the actual follow-up that we had for everyone was in the 2-year range.
2-year range, I'm sorry.
And the thing that's important about that is that 2 years has been considered the gold standard for studies of recidivism.
Right.
So, you know, oftentimes people lament, well, this program was evaluated, but they only looked at the first 6 months, or they only looked at the first year.
Right.
And so 2 years has sort of obtained sort of a golden hue that,
sure.
you know, it's like the magic alpha 0.05 in statistics, you know, that you know, it's like, well, we need 2 years and that's what we want to aim for.
Right.
And so that's what we did here is we got 2 years. And as I say, the results were suggestive. And even at 2 years, we could see that people who were participating in the program, the further out we went, and we're talking about arrest as an outcome,
mm-hmm.
the people that had been in the programs did seem, the further out we went, to be doing a little bit more better.
Now, I do. Okay, so let's segue into that. A five-year study?
The five-year study, we found, actually,
Of the same group.
Of the same groups with the same people. We found that, ironically, you know, shortly after we had stopped looking the first time,
right.
that the results were statistically significant. The
right.
differences in outcomes had become large enough between our comparison subjects and the people who had been in Savory programs, a horrible acronym
yes.
On paper, but that's what it was called, the Savory Serious and Violent,
Serious
Offender,
and Violent Offender
Reentry Initiative.
Okay.
The people who had been in Savory programs were actually, the further out you went, the better they were doing.
Okay.
So that by the time we got to the end of, you know, roughly the 5 years that we were following them, there was a pretty substantial difference.
Now, let's talk about those differences. The differences were better for women and then juveniles and then men.
In terms of, well, and let's back up. And
okay,
you and
please.
I talked about this earlier.
Please.
I mean, the arrest recidivism rate for all of the subjects was very, very high.
Okay.
And that's not surprising, I don't think, to anyone who understands. This initiative was supposed to focus on serious and violent offenders. And what that basically, at minimum, meant is these were frequent flyers.
Yes.
They were people that had been, you know, they started young and they had been very, you know, consistent in their number of arrests that they had. They had long arrest histories. And so when they were released post-release, I mean, we were talking about 75 to 80 to 90% rearrest rates overall. If you just looked any arrest within 5 years of release, you basically, for the men, it was almost all of them.
Now, at the same time, researchers and people within the reentry community over the course of the last 5 years have really emphasized this particular group, that we should not be wasting our time, not be wasting our efforts. And here we are, as we sit in Washington, D.C.,
right.
we're looking at some significant budget cuts.
Right.
People are saying we shouldn't be wasting our time with lower-level offenders. We're going to get the biggest bang for our buck in terms of these higher risk offenders, the kind of the very right. people that you all evaluated. So you all did what it was that you were supposed to do in terms of looking at this particular group.
That's right. And you know, and so, you know, like I say, for the men and to a lesser extent, but certainly at a very high level, everybody got rearrested at least once,
okay.
basically.
All right.
But, you know, when we started looking at the time to the first arrest, when we started looking at the number of arrest, we saw substantial, meaningful differences. I mean, for the women, as you said, I mean, it was about half.
Right.
The women who had been in the Savory program had about half the number of arrests
right.
as the women who were comparisons.
To their comparison group.
Right. And
we're talking about not individual instances of arrest, but we're talking about total arrest.
Total numbers of arrests post-release.
Okay.
And, you know, so in the follow-up period
right.
that we were interested in.
Right.
And for the men, we saw, you know, a half, 0.7 arrest. Now, you might say that's not...
What percentage?
It's like it was about... I don't know, 20% or so. I don't know. I don't need to look. But it was like the comparison group was about 3.5 arrests on average in the follow-up period.
Okay.
And the treatment group was about 3.
Okay.
So you're talking about a half an arrest per person.
Okay.
Well, you know, you think about the cost associated with, you know, the arrest and subsequent prosecution and,
right.
and, you know, whatever the punishment is, and that's
there, there's
not trivial.
There's still enormous implications. So
yes.
if you're talking about a 20% reduction for men
right.
in terms of total arrest, if you're
right.
talking about a 45 to 50% reduction in total arrest for women, and then you're talking about a smaller amount for juveniles.
Right. And the juveniles, we were only able to follow them for... for the original study period. So the smaller number for juveniles was really only within the original study period. There are some research-related reasons for that.
Okay.
That you know we don't need to go into here. But okay. But there was a you know there was a difference, and it was meaningful. And
okay.
I'm looking at the numbers now, and it was 3.75 for the comparison group, 3.25 arrest for the treatment group.
Okay, but give me percentages because that's the difficulty in terms of a lot of people within our audience. They're not going to quite sure as to what that means. So if memory serves me correctly, it was about 45% reduction for women, I think, and about a 20% reduction
for
men.
That's right.
Okay,
that's right.
We'll go with that.
That's close enough.
So, and this is we're talking about total arrest, and in terms of incarcerations across the board, because you look at arrest and you took a look at incarcerations, generally speaking, about 50% went back to prison.
That's correct.
So, you know, first of all, a variety of observations. There was a piece of research which still remains the gold standard in terms of recidivism to this day, done using a cohort back in 1994, the Bureau of Justice Statistics of the Office of Justice Programs of the U.S. Department of Justice. Basically, they gave rates of somewhere in the ballpark of 2/3 rearrested and 50% reincarcerated. And those reincarcerations also included new crimes as well as violations that they committed while out. So in some ways, your particular piece of research tracks that 1994 study, which followed offenders for 3 years.
That's correct.
So basically, what we're saying is that across the board, this is going to be a pretty tough group to deal with. And considering that you dealt with specifically serious and violent offenders, not offenders across the board,
right. But
serious and violent offenders, the fact that you had higher rates of rearrest, but basically the same rates of reincarceration is not surprising. I mean, your group was more difficult to deal with.
We have a number of reports that describe the, you know, and as you pointed out, they're probably, you know, we've got a foot of reports, and that's probably too many pieces of paper for people to go through. But this was clearly the target population was serious and violent. They clearly were. And that has implications for what you might expect to see.
Heavens, I would have a list of implications about as long as this room.
Yep.
Because, you know, what this is saying to me is that, and what it's saying to media and what it's saying to policymakers and what it's saying to practitioners is that we've got to be in this for the long game. It may not show results at 2 years. It may not show results at 3 years. You've got to take a look at longitudinal data, long-range data. You may have to take a look at 5 years' worth of data before you get a sense as to the impact of the programs that you put in place, and most people don't have the patience for that.
That's right, and I'm sympathetic to that. I've not been well known for my patience, but so I think you need to look along at how the results are. Our hypotheses with respect to what's going on here. The thinking has always been, well, if you do an intervention, if it's going to have an impact, it'll have an impact immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then it may diminish over time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the thinking that people have. And in fact, what we found was the opposite. It had a little effect at first, and then over time, it had a greater effect.
But what that does is, here's the drill, though.
Yeah.
Okay, I represent a federal criminal justice agency. Right. We could have a program in place. Year one, the results aren't very good. Year two, the results aren't very good.
Right.
So somebody comes along and says, Mr. Sipes, we'd like to see the results of your research. We provide those results, and somebody declares the program a failure. The program could be a success, but we have to extend it and learn from it and get better at it. And then after multiple years, beyond 2 years, that's when you have your impact.
Right.
That's a tough hoe to row.
And so maybe there are some policy implications here that, you know, things that we need to be mindful of.
I'm sorry. I just realized I just messed that statement up entirely. But go ahead.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, I mean, I think that there are things that we need to be mindful of here. And what we and, you know, my colleagues who worked with me, and there were many who worked with me on this study, have speculated is that what we were seeing is sort of post-release the likelihood that people who've been in prison for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, they get out and they may, you know, they're on supervision, so they may violate. They want to go out and hang around with their friends again. They get themselves in trouble and really don't have time to get themselves sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can think about criminal behavior, it's kind of recidivism is like a relapsing behavior.
Yes.
And sometimes it can take, you know, the treatment community says it can take a while for the treatment to take.
Multiple interventions before you finally get the person on the right road.
And so you provide services to people that they may not use right away, but that in the end, when they finally make it up in their minds that they want to try to do something about their behavior, they've got the tools that they need to move forward.
We're more than halfway through the program in this very, very, very fascinating discussion with Dr. Pam Lattimore. She is principal scientist with Research Triangle Institute. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, Research Triangle Institute has been around for decades. When I left the police department decades ago and started my criminological studies, the first thing I think I read was a piece of research from Research Triangle Institute. They've been around for a long time. Crime and violence and justice research program. That's what she represents. www.rti.org. And we're also going to be placing a link in the show notes to the report that we're talking about, Serious and Violent Offender Reentry Initiative, a 2-year study and a 5-year study. And it took 5 years to show the true effects of the program. And Pam, in the second half of the show, so people are sitting, listening to this program, and they're saying to themselves, okay, fine. If we got to take the program out for that many years, that has real fiscal implications for us, that has real political implications for us, it has policy implications for us. I mean, so first of all, there's that basic understanding that results may not be immediate, and that's lesson number one. Lesson number two seems to be that you did discrete variables. In other words, you isolated certain things, services that had more impact than others within your report. So that's the second thing that I want to get into, because this has, once again, real policy implications for those of us in the criminal justice system. So you found some interventions that were more powerful than others, correct?
That's correct. And I'd like to go back, if you don't mind,
just to
finish up on what we were talking about before the break.
Okay.
And that is, I think one of the implications of if the relapsing hypothesis is correct,
mm-hmm.
and if the if the idea is that people may have difficulty adjusting post-release from prison,
mm-hmm.
it points, and this study is not the only one. A lot of folks have talked about the importance of that first 90 days post-release.
Right.
Now, these programs were supposed to provide pre-release services and post-release services.
Right.
And there was supposed to be, you know, sort of a reasonable handoff.
Mm-hmm.
The report that we're talking about primarily today is based primarily on the services that people received while they were in prison. And there's two reasons for that, but the most important is probably our results suggested that people, by and large, did not receive a lot of services post-release.
Ah, no, wait a minute. Wait, let's back up now.
That's right.
So the bulk of these services came within the incarcerated setting.
That's right.
And then, and this is a very important point. And then the services that were supposed to ease the transition into the community, in many cases, those services were not there.
That's right. That's right.
Well, how can you do one and not the other? I mean, taking a look at all the research that I've looked at, it is crucial that when you come out of the prison system, that it be a seamless continuum of services. So if you're getting substance abuse treatment within the incarcerative setting, then you've got to continue it in some way, shape, or form, whether it's AA or NA. At least you've got to continue that when you come out into the community.
Right. And the short answer to your why is because it's hard to do.
Okay.
And there was large variation across the sites in terms of post-release, the amount of post-release programming. And our original report dealt with that more than the 5-year study did.
Mm-hmm.
And So, I mean, I think one lesson, though, from that is that there needs to be continued attention paid to how to make that transition. If you think about this organizationally, I mean, what is reentry programming is extremely hard to do.
Yes.
Extremely hard to do because of the geography of it. So if you establish a program in a state prison, mm-hmm. and so you have 200 offenders in that prison, in that program.
And if they're in Kansas, they could be hundreds of miles away from that prison.
They could be hundreds of miles away from that prison. And so you have these 200 people, and they get and say you've got sort of a cohort type of program. So
right.
everybody comes in, and everybody spends 3 months or 6 months or whatever
right.
in some core set of services.
Okay.
You let them go. And they, you know, and this is all, let's just say, hard as you would know, and everybody, a lot of folks listening would understand how hard it is to know exactly when people are going to get out and
right.
to gauge all that. But say you could do that. Then these individuals get out in Kansas,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, 20 of them go to Kansas City, and the other 80 of them go.
It's hard to coordinate services over a large geographic area. What percent of the offenders that you studied in terms of your 16 states, what percent did receive adequate post-release services in your estimation?
I'm not sure how to define adequate.
Less than 50%.
Oh, way less than 50%.
Okay. So we're talking about way less than 50%, and that's certainly going to have an impact in terms of program
right,
findings.
Right. Oh, way less than 50%. I haven't looked at those numbers in a while, but yeah, way less than 50%.
So a crucial ingredient was missing.
Right. And I think, you know, and I'll just say it again. This is hard. If this were easy, it would have been done before.
Right.
And so, but that's a very hard thing to say to policymakers. I've tried. Lord
right.
knows I've tried.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I think that until we come to grips with the reality of the fact that this is hard,
mm-hmm.
you know, we don't stand very much of a chance of making it succeed. And so I think we need to learn from, each iteration of this. I mean, if cancer treatment were held and funding were held to the same standard that criminal justice research and evaluation, you know, criminal justice evaluation were held to, we would have no cancer research.
Or drug treatment across the board.
That's
because
correct.
Because there are very defined guidelines
right.
In terms
right.
of what constitutes good
right.
drug treatment.
Right.
All right, we only have about 6 minutes left in the program, and I do want to get back to that very important variable.
Right.
Some parts of these programs seem to have a greater impact than others.
Right.
Talk to me about that.
The five-year study was supposed to be a follow-on to the original study in a couple of ways. One is the longer follow-up, but the other was we wanted to look not just whether or not people had been in a Savory program, but at the impact in terms of numbers of services people
mm-hmm.
received and so forth. Well, when we initially tried to do that, we were just going to make a score,
mm-hmm.
basically. Okay, this person got 12 services or 20 or whatever
right.
number we were using, and this
right.
person got two.
Right.
And did the person who got 20 do better than the person who got two?
Right.
And the results were no. And we thought, okay. And so we started looking at the data. And then we sort of backtracked and said, well, let's look at the effect of individual services.
Mm-hmm.
And once we did that, we found that in a few instances, not only were the services not effective,
mm-hmm.
they were actually having a criminogenic effect.
Mm-hmm.
A detrimental effect.
Okay.
And it's like, okay, if you add up something that's having a bad effect with something that's having a good effect, it's not surprising you find no effect.
What worked?
Education.
Education.
And,
what kind of education?
Our education variable was sort of a sum of
an eighth grade certificate, high school,
eighth grade,
GED,
high school, GED, but you know, vocational
plumbing,
training
plumbing,
as opposed to
electrical,
right? Vocational training,
okay.
You know, those kinds of things. So,
and there's good hard research that backs it up outside of your study.
There's some.
So what else?
And we found that services, by and large, that were directed at improving the individual as a person and maybe helping that individual learn not to do drugs, to changed their criminal thinking, that those services had positive impacts.
Okay, what we call in within the field cognitive behavioral therapy, we're
CBT,
talking about
right?
thinking for a change.
Right.
We're talking about helping that person come to grips with their behavior and making better decisions, which a lot of people think is very commonplace and very simple because that's what we were taught by our parents. In many cases, the individuals caught up within the prison system did not have that education.
That's exactly right. And then we found that, you know, to a large extent, that the services that it didn't have any effect or maybe had slightly detrimental effects were the practical services,
mm-hmm.
you know, housing, well, not housing in this case, but reentry planning. That was a surprise.
Okay.
Now, we think that that the reentry planning variable may have been because people had reentry planning, but then there was, you know, when they there was either no transition post-release
right.
or they didn't have other things.
The lack of follow-up in the community.
Okay. And so people were disappointed. And so,
okay.
therefore, maybe they were doing better. It certainly, for us, really raised the question of something I don't think we know. Psychologists the field had started to drift. I mean, we have to remember these programs were established in 2003.
Right.
And so we're 10 years past that.
And we've come a long way since
then.
Of the research and in terms of our understanding
right.
as to what works.
Right. But clearly there's evidence here to support the CBT and that
CBT.
The cognitive behavioral therapy thinking for change and those kinds of things.
We have to go after the core of the individual right. in terms of how he or she sees themselves as a functioning human being, and maybe that is, and that plus occupational training, those two variables may be mm-hmm. the most important ingredients in terms of good reentry.
Right. And so, practical services, you know, helping people do resumes and job skills, I mean, you know, so interviewing skills and all that, well, are those going to be helpful? They may be helpful after people have had, you know, sort of come to terms with themselves in terms of changing their criminal identity.
Stabilizing the core of the individual. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why we at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, I mean, with the serious offenders and women offenders, we put them in groups with that philosophy of changing the core,
right.
of having that person change the core as to who they are and before they move on to other services
right.
that we could provide.
Right.
We only have 3 minutes left, and I need a minute to close. Are there any other overarching lessons that people need to know when they're talking about this piece of research on serious and violent offenders?
I want to say that just to follow on what I was saying about the importance of sort of criminal identity and change and all of that, we are about to commence on what will be a 9 to 10 year follow-up on a subset of the individuals who were in the original study.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a desistance study that's going to look, we're going to re-interview individuals, men and women, in two states that participated, about 750 of them who mm-hmm. participated in the original study. And some of them will be in prison. I mm-hmm. fully expect at least half of them will be in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to try to find the other half out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to know two things. This study that we had just concluded was really interested in the factors that were associated with recidivism. The new study will look at that, but it's also going to look at factors related to individual change, identification of self and those kinds of things with respect to why people desisted from crime.
Is there a way of ferreting out those people who did get good aftercare services once they're released from prison and look at their recidivism rates?
We have done some of that, and it's not really obviously it's not in the report. It wasn't anything that we felt was useful. I mean,
okay.
I think what we need to understand is that the things that may cause people to stop crime are different from the things that may keep people continuing crime.
Okay.
And that we know a good bit about the things that cause continuation, that causes recidivism,
mm-hmm.
drug use, and
mm-hmm.
those kinds of hanging out with the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know very much about the people that are the reasons, the factors that are associated with why people decide to quit. And we think that those are associated with an individual's identity as well as their commitment maybe to family and children. And we need to learn more about that.
You know, I think this is one of the most fascinating studies that has come out of the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Justice Programs, and I really want to commend you all for this five-year commitment to guiding the rest of us within the criminal justice system. Ladies and gentlemen, the show today was on serious and violent offenders, a five-year analysis, a serious and violent offender reentry initiative. Our guest today is Dr. Pam Lattimore. She is the principal scientist of the Research Triangle Institute. She is with the Crime, Violence, and Justice Research Program, www.rti.org, www.rti.org, and a direct link to the research that we've been talking about today will be in the show notes. You know, this is D.C. Public Safety, and we really do appreciate all the comments that you give back to us and criticisms and suggestions for new shows. We really do appreciate the feedback, and we want everybody to have themselves a pleasant day.